Negotiations for a ceasefire in Gaza show promise, but the UN warns it must be immediate as there's only a small window of time to avoid mass starvation.
In northern Gaza, there are about 300,000 people over there. This is a place where famine is imminent between now and end of May.
Plus, the UN Weather Agency issues a red alert on climate change after record heat and ice melt in 2023. Will humanity take the action needed?
Earth is issuing a distress call. The latest state of the global climate report shows a planet on the brink.
And European leaders are talking about ways to beef up Ukraine's ammunition and shore up their own defenses amid Russian threats and uncertainty about future U.S. support. Today is Saturday, March 23rd. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hello there, I'm Lori London in Washington. A ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas is getting closer. That according to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on his sixth visit to the Middle East since the Israel-Hamas war began.
A very strong proposal was put on the table, and we have to see if Hamas can say yes to the proposal. If it does, that's the most immediate way to alleviate the misery of people in Gaza, which is very much what we want.
Speaking with Al Arabiya News in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, before making stops in Egypt and Israel, Blinken's comments came amid dire warnings about an unfolding humanitarian disaster in Gaza, which could become more dire if Israel follows through on its plans for a ground incursion into Rafah.
We've been very clear, President Biden's been very clear, that we cannot support a major ground operation, military operation in Rafah. There are, as you know, 1.4 million or so civilians in Rafah, many of them displaced from other parts of Gaza. There's no effective way of getting them out of the way into safety.
But time is running out. A UN report released this week by the International Community's Authority on determining the severity of hunger crises said famine is imminent in northern Gaza, where 70% of people are experiencing catastrophic hunger.
Famine could break out at any time.
Ryan Paulson, director of the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization, said mass casualties are looming without an immediate ceasefire.
Well before any finding of famine takes place, people are already in extreme hunger and experience profound suffering. Malnutrition is spiking. Mortality numbers are going up. The message here, colleagues, is that the international community should not wait for famine.
And he said further escalation of the war could push around half of Gaza's total population to the brink of starvation. And joining us now is analyst Rob Voss, who co-authored a concurring report from the International Food Policy Research Institute. We're hearing the word imminent from your latest report, as well as the IPCC report. What is the latest assessment?
Well, the latest assessment is precisely that. It says imminence. The only reason for that is that a few of the, what we call the famine thresholds, could not be fully validated, meaning that more than 20% of the population should be with extreme shortages of food, but that threshold's been well surpassed. There's more than 50% of the population, we estimate, is in that condition, and certainly in the northern part of Gaza, that's the case. There's the high likelihood that the other thresholds, is one more than one-third of the children are acutely malnourished. The latest assessment of more than a month ago said it was at least one in six, but probably it's already close to more than one-third. So, but certainly the projection is that as conditions continue as they are, that threshold, if it hasn't been surpassed already, will be surpassed in the next few weeks. The other threshold is for child mortality, and that's also a number for which there's very difficult to get precise estimates because of the difficulty in the situation. But what's for sure is that child mortality is rising, and that lack of food is the main cause. So that's why the wording is a bit cautious, since famine is a very strong word, but that's why it's imminent. But it's for sure there's no doubt that famine will be declared for a majority of the Gaza population if the situation doesn't change drastically immediately.
The word famine is something that is only used with very specific, as you mentioned, criteria, when that criteria is met. And there are phases. Can you just sort of explain what this latest assessment of the food insecurity phase classification means? Obviously, this is something that is not used, a word that's not used lightly.
Yeah, what the phases mean is that it classifies the population by severity of food insecurity. And the basic idea behind food insecurity is people simply don't have enough food to eat to have a minimally healthy life. So phase one is when there's no food insecurity, so people are generally considered to be food secure with enough access to food. In phase two, we classify people when they're stressed, meaning that they probably have enough to come by, but it's difficult and they may have to sacrifice other things to in order to have enough to eat. Then in phase three, which we call crisis, that's when people have a significant deficit of food. It's also probably visible in high child malnourishment, and in which case we consider that without food assistance and livelihood assistance, will not be able to come by. And then phase four is extreme. That's when a lot of food assistance will be needed and that the food gaps is very high. And then phase five is what we call famine or catastrophe. It's basically when people are at the risk of dying from a lack of access to food.
Is the assessment at stage five or close to stage five?
Well, what we are saying is that at the moment, we estimate that between 600,000 people are in stage five. So that's more than a third of the total population. And that it's projected that in the coming days or weeks that number will rise for the entire Gaza Strip to over 1 million, which means that more than 50% will be in that stage. And then under that in phase four, the estimation is that there's near 900,000 people in that category, and that's many of those are likely to move into phase five if nothing happens. So that's sort of the situation we have. And then there's another near 600,000 people in phase three, which means that there's basically all of the population either in phase three, four, or five. So that's extreme, such extreme that we've never seen in any other context that we have to classify the entire or near the entire population into a crisis level or worse. That's extreme. And that may be a full 100% moving forward, but as I said, with probably more than 50% or more in phase five, again, that's unprecedented in the history of the integrated phase classification system.
So there's never been anything in a situation to this magnitude? Is that what you're saying? Literally this many
people? Yeah, certainly not in the history of the IPC, which is now is in existence of about 20 years. So we've never seen a situation where, relatively speaking, the situation has been this extreme. And even just having more than 1 million people in famine-like conditions or in famine, that's also not happened before.
So basically half the population currently and more in the coming weeks likely are on the brink of starvation.
Exactly. Yeah.
Is there any possible way to avert this imminent massive human catastrophe?
Well, the only way we can avert this is that the conditions are created that food assistance can come in adequate ways, but also would mean an immediate ceasefire such that people feel safe to access foods that then would be provided. And it would mean is that the borders would need to be opened for food supplies on land and that aid workers can operate to provides in the proper way that food. That's the only way in which we can still avert this. And of course, there's already quite a few people in phase five, so hopefully most of them can still be safe, but they're of course at risk already as we speak now. And so of course there's contradicting stories of how much food is coming in. Israel says that they're allowing everything that's needed to come in, but the estimates done by the aid aid agencies, by the UN bodies that operate there, is that at the moment it's about one-fifth of what used to go in actually is arriving into the country, and that given the decrease of the needs for humanitarian assistance, that also means that it's even much less than is actually needed. So a lot needs to happen, but we can still avert it if we do get to a ceasefire, and that immediately the aid agencies can start providing food, water, providing medicine, and all those basic needs that are needed. And also that there's no further pressure on people to move further away from their livelihoods, as has already happened, since about 85% of the population has moved away from their livelihoods because of the security situation.
So it sounds like it can't be a matter of weeks to have some kind of ceasefire agreement. It needs to be immediate.
It has to be days. Yeah, it has to be immediate. And also aid workers should be allowed to do their work. And that's also another problem, is that the aid distribution is not properly working at the moment, not just because not enough supplies come in, but also because there are constraints on the UN workers that are operating in the Gaza Strip. And also that, also because of the ongoing hostilities, distribution centers have been under attack, and it has been costing lives of people trying to access food, and it's also been costing lives of the aid workers themselves.
So you think it's only a matter of days before the alarm that you're already sounding?
Yeah, it's hard to say, not being in the situation itself, but it is a desperate situation for the millions that live there. So it's unprecedented, as I mentioned. But also, it could be days, could be maybe weeks before we will see people in larger numbers dying from hunger. But we're very close to that situation. And as things proceed as they are, then that will be the inevitable outcome. So things have to change immediately in order to avert a real famine in catastrophic sense of the word.
All right. Thank you very much for taking the time to explain all of this. It's a difficult conversation to have, but it's important to let people know.
Yeah, it is. And as we always say, unfortunately, if one has to declare a famine, it's an expression of that we have failed, right? That we have not been able to prevent this, where this should be a preventable situation, but we cannot at the moment. So let's hope that all parties come to their senses and really make this effort to make a ceasefire happen and allow humanitarian assistance in large quantities flow into the area.
Rob Voss with the International Food Policy Research Institute. The European Union's 27 leaders gathered in Brussels this week for a two-day summit with the Middle East and Ukraine at the top of the agenda. President Volodymyr Zelensky joining via video link. We're joined now by Thomas Graham, Distinguished Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. So EU leaders have voiced increasing alarm in recent weeks as ammunition-starved Ukrainian forces are struggling to hold back Russian troops. How serious are their concerns?
Well, it will be serious conversation, and the alarm is growing for two reasons. First, the situation on the battlefield in Ukraine itself has been moving against Ukraine. The Russians are showing initiative across the entire front at this point. But that is coupled with the continued inability of the Biden administration to get its supplemental request for $60 billion through the U.S. Congress. And I think the European leaders are worried about whether that indeed will come through at some point and at the appropriate level, and whether Ukraine will have the type of support it needs to fortify the lines and consolidate its position against this Russian offensive. So you've got the offensive on the ground that is going against Ukraine at this point, and very serious questions about continued U.S. funding.
And as far as the European Union goes, there's a new sense of urgency due to the fact that Russia may not stop at Ukraine, and there are concerns that the U.S. may not be such a staunch protector of Europe, given the election campaign. It's raising questions about fearing it needs to ramp up its own ability to provide its own security.
Well, it's needed to do that for some time. I think recent developments have driven that point home. I think it's an exaggeration to say that Russia somehow succeeds in Ukraine, whatever that means, that the next thing it's going to do is to roll into the Baltic states in Poland. Remember, this conflict in Ukraine was supposed to be a three-day war, maybe a three-week war. We're now in the third year. This is hardly an overwhelming demonstration of Russian military capabilities, and it will take Russia some time to reconstitute its own military forces, given the losses that it is suffering in Ukraine. Nevertheless, I think it is clear that Europe faces a growing security challenge from Russia over the long term, and it needs to be able to build up its defense forces to deal with that, to deter in the first instance, and then to defend itself if for some reason it should come to a shooting war. That would be true no matter what the politics are in the United States. U.S. administrations have been pushing Europeans to provide more for their defense for many, many years now, actually probably since the beginning of the alliance, but clearly in the past decade or so, in part because the United States would like to be able to shift some of its resources from Europe to other places that we find a challenge for the United States in the future, you know, specifically the Indo-Pacific region, dealing with China as a major global power. But no matter what happens in November, there's going to be pressure on the Europeans to raise their defense spending, to develop a more robust defense policy, better coordinated defense policy, to meet the target of 2% of GDP spent on defense that all NATO members are supposed to be aiming at this point. If Trump is elected in November, I think the situation becomes, I think, from a European standpoint, somewhat more dire, given what Trump has said about his clear lack of enthusiasm for alliances, whether it be Europe and elsewhere, would be a cause of concern. That, I think, sort of accelerates the problem, but it doesn't radically change the point that Europe does need to spend more on its defense, in part because the United States is not going to be able to back it up the way it has in past decades.
Do you think that even though it was a preordained victory in Vladimir Putin's recent re-election, do you think that this has just essentially created a more emboldened Russia that is cause for even greater concern along those borders and with those NATO countries?
Well, you know, I find it somewhat amusing that we talk about Russia as an autocracy and then act as if the election is sort of a major turning point in domestic politics that allows Russia to do things that it wouldn't have done, Putin to do things that he wouldn't have done before. You know, the election, I think, is important in the sense that Putin has once again demonstrated his sort of mastery of the Russian political system. Whether that emboldens him significantly or not, I think, is another question. He feels, I think, increasingly confident about his own position in Russia, but that has nothing in particular to do with the elections. The economy has grown over the past year, despite Western sanctions and despite the widespread predictions when the West began the sanctions regime that the Russian economy would collapse. The Russians withstood the Ukrainian counteroffensive last fall, and you see growing sort of Ukraine defeat fatigue in the West, and particularly in the United States. All those matters embolden Putin. The victory in the election, for what it's worth, sort of add to that, but I don't think it radically changes the way Putin thinks about his situation and what we might need to do or what he might plan to do in the near term. You know, final point here is, despite the fact that the initiative on the battlefield is now Russia's, it isn't as if it's making radical progress on the ground. You know, it took a town about a month or so, Adiivka, but the costs were horrific in terms of lives lost and equipment destroyed. So it isn't rolling through Ukraine at this point. It still has a tough fight ahead, and this is despite the fact that the Ukrainians are low on munitions, that it has certain problems with manpower and so forth. So, I don't think Putin is emboldened to the extent that he's going to develop grandiose plans and put those into effect in the near term. Right now, we're dealing with the situation in Ukraine, and that's not to mention the other problems, longer-term problems of demographic problems in Russia, educational problems, economic problems that are there and will continue to be there, no matter what the United States and its Western allies does as far as sanctions are concerned.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your taking the time to speak with us.
You're certainly welcome.
Thomas Graham, Distinguished Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. You're listening to VOA's Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. The other major issue in the news this week, our warming planet. The UN Weather Agency released its annual State of the Global Climate Report Tuesday with a red alert that every major global climate record was broken last year.
The climate crisis is the defining challenge that humanity faces.
World Meteorological Organization Secretary General Celeste Saulo said it's highly probable that 2024 will be even hotter. The report found over 90% of the world's oceans experienced heat wave conditions, with a big plunge in Antarctic sea ice. Saulo says it's a warning that the world's efforts to reverse the trend have been inadequate.
The cost of climate action may seem high, but the cost of climate inaction is much higher.
So will countries follow through on their climate commitments? I spoke with Andrew Furman, who co-authored a recent report by the Global Civil Society Alliance Civicus on the state of civil society when it comes to climate, as the clock is ticking to prevent the worst impacts.
We're looking at trends in activism over the last year, and looking at what's happening to climate activism, particularly in Europe and North America, we've seen a growing use of restrictions against climate protests, more legal restrictions, more criminalization. And that's really striking, because these are generally the countries that talk a big game internationally, like to talk up their climate promises. And what we think is happening is that these very well-established climate movements in these countries are calling out this gap between rhetoric and practice. And in doing so, they're embarrassing governments and fossil fuel companies, and that's attracting increased restriction. We're calling this, you know, the new frontier of climate denial, because outright denial of the climate science, that's pretty rare these days. You know, most governments will acknowledge the science and say they're trying to achieve net zero and things like that. But delay is a form of climate denial, because the need to act on to cut emissions, it's urgent, we need to do it fast. So if you're delaying action, that's a form of climate denial. And if you're silencing the voices that are calling for urgency, calling for you to move much faster, then that's denial. And that's what we're seeing happening, particularly, as I say, in Europe and North America.
Are you saying there's an effort to repress climate activists?
Yes, and it's really striking. For example, new laws have been introduced in the UK against noisy and disruptive protests, clearly targeted at the kind of direct action the climate movement takes. Another law has been introduced in Italy around the sites of protests and protests at cultural sites. Again, that's targeted at direct action. In Germany, you've seen last year we saw laws that are supposed to be used against organised crime being used against young activists from the last generation group just for protests and direct action. In the Netherlands, thousands of people were detained last year for blocking of roads in protest to call for an end to fossil fuel subsidies. So we're seeing this really striking pattern. Australian states as well, and a lot of states in the US have introduced various laws to restrict the site of protests. So this is a really growing pattern. And the alarming thing is that climate activists in the global south have long had to live with these kind of restrictions, and that's always been a problem. But people in European and North American countries have been relatively free to protest. And of course, that's important, because that's where many of the big oil companies are based. That's where many of the big emitting governments are based. So this is a really alarming trend that we're seeing.
So in this report, along with all of these concerning issues, were there any positives to come out as far as climate?
Yes. I mean, the really exciting thing is that the global climate movement is incredibly resilient. So even when it's being met with these attempts at repression, there's a response. We saw in Germany, when the government froze bank accounts, climate protesters were able to raise more than the money had been frozen for crowdfunding. We've seen in Uganda, where there's been a particular threat against a movement trying to stop oil pipeline development, despite immense restriction, they've been able to get a number of banks to commit to not financing it. We're also seeing the growing use of court cases, climate litigation. There's been a lot in the USA, including a court case by a young activist in Montana last year, but there's also a successful court case in Belgium recently, a court which will force the government to move faster to cut its emissions. And that's a growing field of civil society action. And what we're seeing is, you know, the scale of the climate crisis is so vast that people are working on all these fronts simultaneously. So even if protests press is repressed, there are still other avenues people will try to use to hold their governments and fossil fuel companies to account.
Andrew Furman, co-author of the Civicus annual State of Civil Society report. Andrew Furman, we thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.